You know, as Pastor Jay mentioned, both here locally, nationally, in some horrific, generationally horrific news headlines from the things, the tragedy just across the highway at Annunciation to the assassination of Charlie Kirk that, I mean, many people saw on their phones as they were scrolling. It's a very, very difficult time to navigate. And on top of that, there's an interesting, a strange thing that's also happening in our culture. You know, you'd think with all of these really difficult, tense, anxiety-inducing headlines, you'd think that people with their free time would go to the movie theater and, you know, watch something comforting or turn on the television and, you know, maybe put on the Andy Griffith Show or, you know, something like that. But it's interesting, this past year, some of the biggest box office successes have been horror movies. And actually, we've seen over the last few decades, you know, horror as a storytelling mechanism has long been around in the Western tradition. That's nothing new. You can go back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and, you know, but there has been an increase in a particular kind of frightening scenario that is really fascinating to see spread throughout our culture. And you could call this the post-apocalyptic story, right? So everything from Mad Max to Terminator to zombie movies to nuclear holocaust, I mean, it's an interesting new genre. And I've got a couple of friends that are pretty well-established psychologists, behavioral scientists, and I've been talking to them about this. Like, why do people, when they continually are already exposed to really horrific, frightening things, are sitting at the movie theater or sitting on their couch watching these sorts of stories? And it's been interesting to hear their feedback. They point to a couple of different psychological theories, one of which is, you know, the post-apocalyptic Mad Max, Terminator, you know, zombie flick is in one sense a way that we envision, if we do not course correct our behaviors, we are imagining in pretty fantastical ways what civilization and the world might descend into if we don't course correct, right? There's always a kind of hidden message in those movies about if we don't change our behavior in this way, it will lead to this thing. Even if the thing is totally fantastic and outside of, you know, a zombie apocalypse is not realistic, but what's behind those fears? It's an interesting psychological insight. But then there's another component to that. There is the component of imagining, well, what would it be like if we lived through that and made it to the other side? This is the post-apocalyptic part of the horror scenario, the post-apocalyptic genre. And, you know, this is a really, really popular genre. It's a popular genre even, you know, this isn't necessarily my demographic, but maybe, you know, more in the Gen Z world, there are these fully immersive storytelling video games like Fallout and The Last of Us, where people are actually playing through scenarios of we've lived through some sort of nuclear holocaust or some sort of zombie apocalypse, and now we're asking, could we ever get back to the place where children can play safely in streets? Where maybe we could live in the kind of neighborhood where we don't have to lock our doors when we go out to the grocery store? People imagining, what would it be like to rebuild after that kind of scenario? This is actually nothing new. These sorts of questions have always been in the human imagination. I want to tell you, while these events that we are seeing on the news and even locally are horrific, the end is always nigh. The end is always nigh. How many of you in here, just by a show of hands, you grew up and in your school, you had lockdown drills? You know, we do have some kids in here. You had lockdown drills, okay? Those are pretty frightening, right? How many of you in here grew up in a time in which there was atomic bomb drills at school? The end is always nigh. There's always instances of horrific suffering that we're bracing ourselves for and trying to figure out how do we prevent it, and what does it look like to rebuild in the midst of that? And I want to take you back, because this is nothing new in human history, and it's nothing new even in the biblical text. I want to take you back around 586 years before Christ, to the time that the Hebrew prophets, like Jeremiah and Isaiah, had long foretold. The kingdom of Israel at this point had split in the north and the south into two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel and Judah, and had for generations continued to do things that the prophets said, if you continue in this way, it's going to lead to apocalypse. It's going to lead to a great ruin. Isaiah, Jeremiah, they warned them, you continue in this course, Israel, this will be the result. And they gave them even, if you read like the prophetic books like Isaiah and Jeremiah, you see scenarios that, as the prophetic description sounds like, it's like something from Mad Max or something from a zombie apocalypse movie. It's terrible. It's frightening. It was intended to warn them of that potential future. And at times, you know, people did make in Israel. They made concerted effort to repent and to turn and to veer away from that course. But they always seemed stuck in this cyclical pattern of like, okay, we're going to repent for a little bit, but then we return back to the very things that are going to lead to ruin. And eventually that cycle reached its end. And in 586 BC, the Babylonians descended upon Jerusalem. And the best description I could give you of this is it looked like something akin to a zombie horde in a post-apocalyptic movie. They descended on Jerusalem. They burned the temple and the city to the ground. This is, of course, an artistic rendering of that horrific scene. They took the bodies of the slain and they stacked them outside the walls of the city in a place called the Valley of Hinnom. And just as an interesting aside, when you read in the New Testament, in the Gospels, when Jesus, in our English translations, when you see Jesus use the word hell as he is forewarning of, if we do not change our trajectory, there will be a day of judgment. 11 out of 14 references to hell, Jesus is using an Aramaic word that means the Valley of Hinnom. His audience knows what he's referring to. His audience gets it. Now, the Babylonians didn't actually kill everyone in this scene. Some of them were hauled off into captivity in Babylon, and it's in captivity that you get these amazing Sunday school stories, like the story of Daniel, the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. How many of you have heard those stories before, maybe in Sunday school? Okay. Those all take place in a post-apocalyptic world for Israel. They have been hauled off into Babylonian captivity. You also get the story of Esther, these amazing stories of what it looks like after the apocalypse. And of course, in the story of Daniel, you see this interesting change in power. They are brought into Babylonian captivity, and Daniel forewarns that there's going to be an overthrow of power even in Babylon, and the Persians come in, and it's another apocalyptic scene. They overthrow the Babylonians, and now the people of Israel are property of the Persians. One night, the great Persian king Cyrus hears the voice of Israel's God, which is an interesting story. You can see this in the beginning of the book of Ezra. He hears the voice of Israel's God, and he feels as if this God of Israel is saying, you can allow the people of Israel to go back and begin to rebuild. Some of them do. Some of them now, with the permission of King Cyrus, they do go back. Some of them choose to stay in Babylon. And those who return to Jerusalem return to a Last of Us post-apocalyptic scene in Jerusalem. About 140 years after Jerusalem's destruction, there is now this post-apocalyptic rebuilding effort. And one of the leaders in that rebuilding effort, of course, I've already mentioned the book of Ezra. Ezra was one of the key leaders. But I want to focus in today on another leader in this story, a man by the name of Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the Persian king Artaxerxes, and he received word while still being in Babylonian captivity in a really high-ranking position next to the king. He heard he heard reports of the failed rebuilding efforts in Jerusalem, and I want to invite you to open up to Nehemiah 1. We're going to spend most of our time today in the book of Nehemiah. We'll start off in Nehemiah chapter 1. I'll also have the passages on the screen this morning, but if you'd like to follow along in your physical, tangible Bible, feel free. Open up to Nehemiah 1. Nehemiah 1, starting off at verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." Nehemiah hears this report. And so in Nehemiah chapter 2, Nehemiah goes to the king to receive his blessing, to go back to the ruins and devastation of Jerusalem and help in the rebuilding efforts. When he arrives, when Nehemiah gets permission from the king and goes back to Jerusalem, what he sees is post-apocalyptic ruin. The walls of the city have been destroyed. The initial efforts people made to try to rebuild the city gates had been destroyed again by fire. Now, I want you to note here, you can turn over to Nehemiah 2. I want you to note Nehemiah's response as he sees the ruin and the devastation. In Nehemiah 2, looking at verse 17 and 18, "Then I said to them, 'You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace.' I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. They replied, 'Let us start rebuilding.' So they began this good work." Nehemiah possessed one of the attributes that we believe here at First Free. As Pastor Jay mentioned last week, we've been in a 9-month process of discernment as a ministry team, even meeting with outside church consultation to try to name with precision and accuracy what is it that God is calling our church in this particular season to be about and to be on mission. And some of these words we're using to describe what we want to call around here what an everyday disciple of Jesus looks like at First Free, we're trying to give some language to. And today, I want to call your attention to Nehemiah as a model for one of the things we want to be known for and be about at this church. And that is to be people that are known as hopeful builders. A hopeful builder is someone that says, "I join in the work of the kingdom with confident expectation." We want that to be said of us. We want that to be said of our neighbors, of the people that know our church and our church community, that when they describe you and me, they might not use this exact phrase, but this is what we want to be about. We want to be hopeful builders. We say, "I see the work of the kingdom, I'm joining in it, and I'm not just joining in it begrudgingly or depressed. I'm joining in it with confident expectation." This isn't just like happy thoughts, thinking positively. It's not naively denying the challenges of our world, the hardships that we're going to face, nor is it being people that are overwhelmed by fear and anxiety, anxiously ruminating all day and all the devastation and the ruin in the world around us. That's not it. Between those two ditches, we are called to stare the problems of the world in the face and go, "Come, let's rebuild." This is the kind of people we're called to be. To be people of the resurrection, church. To be people of the resurrection means to appropriately stare right in the face of the challenges and the ruin that God has called you and me to, and to be people that say, come, let's rebuild. So I want to invite you now to think more deeply about, what does a hopeful builder look like? What do they look like? And the first thing I want to invite you to consider, especially from the pattern of Nehemiah's life that we see in the book of Nehemiah, is a hopeful builder interprets challenges as opportunities. They see challenges first and foremost as an opportunity. So back when we were in Nehemiah 2, let's look at that passage again, Nehemiah 2, 17, and just notice how Nehemiah confronts the challenge. Remember, he says, you see the trouble we're in. He's not denying it, you know? He's not Pollyanna-ish about it. He sees the ruin. He sees the challenge. But this is how he interprets it. The gates have been burned with fire, and he says, this is a challenge. It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to rebuild. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. The second thing a hopeful builder does is they attend only to the ruin God has called them to. As we mentioned already, right? The end is always nigh. We are always living on the brink of collapse. How many of you lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis? Okay? I mean, that could have been the end of the world right there, right? We've all lived through a global pandemic. We have lived through the sense that we might be at the end of it all. That is always going to be a feature of the human experience until Christ comes and sets all things right. So we have a problem, though. If, like, there is ruin and devastation all around us, we are limited. We can't attend to all of it. So we have to discern, what is the particular ruin, the rebuilding, the building project God has called me to be? You know, in the days of Nehemiah, there were a million other problems in the world. It wasn't just like Jerusalem and his own people had problems. There were problems everywhere. But Nehemiah wasn't called to attend to all of them. That would be impossible. He only attended to the problem that was in his domain to do something about. He was in a position, due to his relationship to the king, to be in a position to say, I can actually do something about it. And I want to give you like a practical encouragement about this, because we live in a day that is different than Nehemiah. Nehemiah didn't have 24/7 cable news. Nehemiah didn't have social media. Nehemiah didn't have talk radio. We have all of these numerous inputs that our biblical forefathers did not have to deal with. We are always being bombarded with things that even just a few generations ago, we would have never been aware of. I was even just reflecting to Jay. I don't know how long after the assassination of JFK that the Zapruder film was released, the film that somebody captured that actually showed the tragic event that day in Dallas, Texas. People didn't see that in real time as they did this week. We are exposed to a range of terrors and horrors that no other people have ever lived with, and we cannot attend to it all. So I want to encourage you. You need to be cautious about the ways in which not good faith actors might want to manipulate your empathy for profit. We live in a 24/7 news cycle where we're constantly bombarded with stories of tragedy. You cannot attend to them all. And here's what you need to realize is that ads are being sold. The commercials, the people are making their checks. They're making their wages off of telling you these stories and capturing your attention, whether it is 24/7 news, whether it's social media influencers. You know, I'm not saying all of them are malevolent, but you have to realize here that a lot of bad news is something that captures our attention and we exchange it for watching an ad that's selling us something. So we should be cautious about, do I need to constantly feed myself with this? Should I have a little bit more discernment as to whether or not, is someone trying to manipulate me to keep me glued to the TV all day long, to keep me scrolling, doom scrolling on my phone all day? Because we were not meant to live with that much awareness of the devastation and ruin all over the world. I want to show you something here. This is really fascinating. So since 2000, negative, emotionally manipulative news headlines have skyrocketed. Anger, disgust, fear, spikes of joy, you know. But anger, disgust, and fear since 2000 have skyrocketed. Emotionally manipulative news headlines. People know that outrage gets attention, and you just need to be aware of this so that you are not constantly feeding your soul on this stuff. Now, if I were to ask you right now, what do you think? Based on, you know, just your experience, what you see on the news headlines, are homicide rates in the U.S. higher or lower than where they were in the 1960s and 70s? Your gut reaction might be to say, oh, they've got to be much higher. Things are much worse. But actually, homicide rates in the U.S. are comparable to where they were in the 1950s, the mid-50s. Now, you might not even be aware of that. Why? Because the perpetual feeding of stories and tragedy, that's something that wasn't necessarily around in the 50s, right? That's not to say like we should be satisfied with our national homicide rates. We need to continue to work to make improvements there. But to be aware, there's a lot of Chicken Little out there. You know the story of Chicken Little, the sky is falling, the sky is falling? There's a lot of that. We can't live with that all the time. And the problem practically becomes, well, what do I give my attention to? There are things in the Middle East, things in my neighborhood, things in Washington, D.C., things here. And what about my family? Like, what if all of my emotional energy all day is given to news headlines of people I actually can't make any practical difference in, and I am scrolling, I catch myself at night scrolling on my phone, doom scrolling, while the kids in my house that I have a limited window of time with are sitting right there. And I go, maybe more of my attention needs to be given to the domain God has entrusted me with. And this is important for us to discern because we can't attend to all of it. Hopeful builders face opposition, but they stay focused on the mission. I want to brace you for when you start participating in building or rebuilding efforts to be people of the kingdom of God, I promise you, you will face opposition. Nehemiah faced opposition. In Nehemiah 6, we can see this in Nehemiah 6, starting off in verse 2b, Nehemiah was facing opposition. But they were scheming to harm me, so I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. Nehemiah faced opposition and people were always trying to pull him into the muck. Be like, here's the problem, Nehemiah, here's the problem. This is never going to work. And Nehemiah was like, I can't waste time with you. I don't have unlimited attention and energy. My energy and attention is focused on the rebuilding project. So he's like, why should I stop the work and just listen to your complaining all day? Why should I allow myself to slow down in the thing God has called me to deal with your constant negativity and opposition? Press on. Press forward. Expect opposition. Attention and energy are a limited resource, and when you're undertaking a challenge, you cannot split that energy and attention infinitely. So as my kids might say, which will embarrass them and now make the phrase obsolete because a middle-aged man is using it, lock in, you know? Lock in. Lock in. Well, there's the rest of the text. Hopeful builders reject cynicism. Notice in the story of Nehemiah that there is an utter lack of cynicism in response to the tragedy and ruin he's been called to. He's not playing the blame game. You know, he's not trying to figure out which side is better or worse. He doesn't have time for that. He's not cynical. And this is a really important point for us because especially, you know, if you are Gen X or younger, you were raised in a particular cultural environment where we saw throughout pop culture and popular media, we saw in influential movies and TV shows this notion that, like, to be a cynic is to actually be the most intelligent person in the room. You know, for you know, like the mid-2000s, I don't know if any of you ever watched that show House. Did anybody watch that show House? House MD, right? House is the smartest guy in the hospital. No one else can figure it out but him. And you know what? He's also the most cynical person that you've ever met before. And we see this all the time, you know, for kind of like the Gen Xers. There was like Tyler Durden in Fight Club. You know, be super cynical. You know, you see the thing for the Gen Z Zoomers. There's Rick Sanchez, you know, just totally cynical, and he's totally brilliant too. But this isn't true, actually. You know, there's a significant number of studies on cynicism that would show, first of all, a 2016 study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology found that cynical individuals scored lower on standardized measures of cognitive ability. They're not actually more intelligent. It's a coping mechanism. A 2019 study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology examined from large-scale cross-cultural surveys found a consistent pattern. Individuals with higher cynical worldviews also earned significantly less income over time. Being cynical is not helping you. You're not more intelligent. It's not helping you make more money. It doesn't work. And actually, it's really, really bad for your physical health. A 2013 study showed that cynical individuals had a higher risk of cardiovascular mortality, independent of traditional risk factors. You're making your heart worse by being more cynical. And actually, finally, one more thing, if that didn't convince you to turn down the cynicism a bit. A 2014 study published in Neurology found that individuals who scored higher in cynical distrust were significantly more likely to develop dementia later in life. There are a range of factors here that should say, if I've ingested this lie that I am more intelligent, I'm better off by being super, super cynical, it's just not true, and I would encourage you, turn down the cynicism. Turn down the cynicism. It's not doing you any good. To be a hopeful builder means I cannot be cynical about this project. I'm living with resurrection hope. It might be something I can't even see right now. It might not even feel like it's possible, this rebuilding effort. And cynicism is not going to help me. Finally, a hopeful builder doesn't do the project on their own. They mobilize others. They empower others. In Nehemiah 3, Nehemiah organizes people according to their gifts and places, the places that they live, and he mobilizes them towards shared mission together. He doesn't centralize, doesn't do the work all himself. He properly delegates. He's got priests, goldsmiths, merchants, entire families repair sections of the wall that are nearest to their neighborhood. He assigns people to work near their homes. And in that way, the mission becomes shared, personal. Everyone has a role, no matter their skill level. I love this. Look at Nehemiah 8 here with me. Then Nehemiah the governor, Ezra the priest, and the teacher of the law, we're in verse 9, sorry, I forgot to mention that fact. And the Levites who were instructing the people said to them all, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep." For all the people had been weeping as they listened to the words of the law. Nehemiah said, "Go and enjoy choice food and sweet drinks, and send some to those who have prepared nothing. This day is holy to our Lord. Do not grieve, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." When they finished the building project, they celebrated together. They had a huge party. This isn't a time to be sad anymore. You did the work. His mobilization and getting people to buy in together to the rebuilding efforts. When they did rebuild, there was a sense of deep, deep joy. And that's important. When you've been a part successfully of a rebuilding effort, and maybe it's just you hit one particular deadline, you know, maybe there's just something you're like, hey, you know, if we can make this change in our school, you know, maybe you're active in your parent-teacher association, you're like, hey, boy, we want to help make this change in our particular school, and that happens, celebrate. Celebrate with the people around you. Celebrate with the team that's been mobilized together. Keep this phrase in mind. It is the joy of the Lord that is our strength. It's not cynicism. It's not the kind of like Eeyore mentality that, yeah, I guess I'm doing this, but I feel terrible about it. The joy of the Lord is our strength. It is an awesome moment. When I see this stuff in the news that we've seen the last few weeks, it's horrific. I grieve, I mourn, I lament, but you know what else I do? I steel my resolve to be the kind of person that says, this is something I'm called to. Now, it might not be that exact thing, but I see in front of me an opportunity to participate in God's renewing work, and that opportunity is there for you as well. So here's a question I want to leave you with today. What are you called to rebuild or to build? All of you have a project. And it might not be to like plant a church or to go on mission or to do some massive nationwide campaign. It might just be in my neighborhood, I want to have dinner once a month with my neighbors, because God has given me a place. Well, there's a great project. There's a great project. You that live right here in South Minneapolis, right? And you know your neighbors are really, really deeply hurting because of the events that just took place here a few weeks ago. What a great rebuilding project for you to say, I can be a hopeful builder right where I am. Might be in your job, your workplace, in your family. Here's what I want you to do real quick, okay? A church isn't a spectator sport. It's a participatory sport here. And as the worship team begins to make their way up, what I want you to do is the people sitting around you, I want to give you just a minute now, and I want to allow you a space to think about the answer to this question. What is God calling me to build or rebuild? And to share it with somebody. Now, if you're coming in today and you're like, Paul, this is my first time coming to church. I don't even know what I think about God. Here's what I would tell you. You know, no pressure to feel like you have to get on the same page with all of our beliefs here. But maybe I'll rephrase the question for you. It's like, you know, what are you passionate about that would actually lead to the flourishing of other people around you? And maybe you don't know that that's God calling you yet, but I'll tell you that's God calling you. You don't have to believe that yet or not. So I want to ask you right now, just take a moment with the person sitting next to you, if it's a family member or someone sitting around you, and just share with them. Simple sentence. You know what? This is something I feel called to. All right? Take a moment now and share with the people, okay? We're going to make this a participatory sport here before we sing together. Share with someone around you. I feel called to this, to rebuild, to build this.